Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump has made his first public comment since last night's missile attack by Iran on U.S. military installations in Iraq. Speaking at the White House today, he said there were no U.S. or Iraqi casualties in the attacks.
Our great American forces are prepared for anything. Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
We're joined now by Leon Panetta, former CIA director and Secretary of Defense under President Obama. Secretary, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So everybody was waiting to see what Iran was going to do in retaliation for the attack that killed Soleimani. And then everybody was waiting to see what President Trump was going to do in response to that retaliation. What did you think of the president's response?
Well, I think the president has pretty much acknowledged the effort by Iran to de-escalate the confrontation with the United States, and in acknowledging what Iran did by a largely symbolic attack that didn't involve any kind of casualties, I think there's an opportunity here to try to de-escalate the situation and try to see if there isn't an effort to try to return to some kind of common sense negotiations.
The president did say he's going to impose new economic sanctions on Iran. Is that the right move?
Well, I think the president will continue to try to bully Iran, and Iran will continue probably to try to bully the United States. But the reality is we are where we're at because both nations have failed to bully the other nation into doing what they wanted to do. And the result is that we have increased the risks of war as a result of that. I would hope that rather than continuing that approach to bullying each other, that there might be a better opportunity here to try to find some kind of reasonable approach to opening negotiations on the differences between the United States and Iran.
The president also, in his response today, blamed the Obama administration for the missiles that were used last night, saying that they were paid for by Iran using the money that they had gotten as part of the Iran nuclear deal. What did you make of that?
I think the president, when he's caught in a corner, always winds up blaming President Obama for whatever's happening, when the reality is that this president does not have a clear or comprehensive strategy on dealing with the Middle East. It's obvious from his own remarks. He's somebody who's very unpredictable. He's at one point talked tough and at the other point talked about getting out of the Middle East. And now is in a situation where there is no clear strategy about how the United States is going to respond to protecting our national security threats in the Middle East. And that, I think, is the biggest concern, is that we have no idea where this president is headed next.
Well, he is now demanding more help from European allies on whatever the strategy may be in the Middle East, from the UK, France, Germany, and from NATO. To put more pressure on Iran. What do you think that U.S. allies are thinking right now?
Well, the U.S. allies, I'm sure, are trying to figure out just exactly what this president is trying to do. Obviously, we're concerned when the president walked away from the nuclear accords and in large measure ignored the efforts of all of the other countries that were involved in negotiating those accords. I am glad that the president is reaching out to those allies. I think that makes the most sense. I think they are probably the strongest weapon we have to try to see if we can't open up some kind of path to negotiating the differences that are involved in dealing with Iran.
Secretary Panetta, what do you think all of this means for the U.S. relationship with Iraq, a country that the U.S. has been involved in, has lost a lot of blood and treasure over the past many decades now?
Well, I think the killing of Soleimani obviously has undermined the relationship with Iraq, and Iraq is now telling us that at some point we should withdraw, which will clearly impact on our national security interests, particularly when it comes to dealing with ISIS. So I think the situation that we're in now is one where our relationship with Iraq has been undermined. We're not clear about what our position is with regards to maintaining and protecting our national security interests in the Middle East. And we're not quite sure just exactly where our relationship with Iran is headed. It's a very unpredictable situation that I think raises concerns about exactly what will happen in the future.
Just a few seconds left, but let me ask you, how much do you think politics are playing into what's going on with the impeachment trial kind of looming over President Trump's head?
Well, there's no question that having an impeachment process going on at the same time we're dealing with these national security threats is not good for the country, and obviously raises a lot of questions about just exactly what the president's intentions are all about. But I do take the White House in many ways at its word, particularly when it comes to dealing with national security threats and the need to respond to those threats. So I hope that the president understands that the country's interests must come first before worrying about how all of this impacts on the election.
Lena Panetta, thank you.
Thank you.
And for more reaction to the crisis with Iran, we spoke earlier today to Congressman Dan Crenshaw, Republican of Texas. He's a former Navy SEAL who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we asked him what he thought the U.S. should do after Iran's attack on U.S. forces in Iraq.
Well, first we need to look at the history of escalation that has happened. Iran has been slowly and methodically escalating in violence against us. And, you know, we can go back a few years and just look at the capturing of U.S. Navy personnel, the boarding of a U.S. Navy vessel, now fast forward to bombing of oil tankers, bombing of a Saudi oil facility, shooting down a U.S. drone, rocket attacks against our bases, killing of a U.S. citizen, and then orchestrating an attack against a U.S. embassy in Baghdad. There's been a long series of escalations, and we have to ask ourselves as Americans, where is our red line? And the president made that clear, which was the killing of a U.S. citizen. And he responded accordingly and took out one of the most preeminent terrorists around the world, responsible for the death of thousands, as well as hundreds of Americans in Iraq. And I think that was the right response. We had to make it clear that Iran could not escalate against us indefinitely, and you had to disrupt that escalation ladder by responding, and that's what the president did. It should be expected that the Iranians were going to respond as they did. Okay, especially in Persian culture, there's a need to save face. There's a need to show your honor by implementing a response. We should have expected that. We did expect it. And that's exactly what we did.
But I want to ask you, I want to ask you about those attacks. Iran's foreign minister said today that Iran doesn't actually want a war with the U.S. and that perhaps they intentionally avoided killing Americans with these attacks. I mean, some could look at this as Iran just trying to save face, attacking the U.S. to claim it retaliated without killing Americans. Your thoughts on this?
I think that's certainly a possibility. I don't know. I don't have all the information that the president has. We should be looking at intelligence reports that would indicate whether or not this was a face-saving gesture. It is certainly a possibility, but I can't say for sure.
Yeah, as you said, the U.S., you believe, was fully justified in killing General Qassem Soleimani, and the White House has said the killing was in response to those imminent threats you've talked about over the last few months, Iran's actions. But what specific information do you have on those threats?
Well, no information that can be given out publicly. You have to remember there's sources and methods that are used to collect intelligence that can't be publicized and most likely won't be publicized. Based on the briefings I've been in, I have a lot of confidence that there was actual imminent threats.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said today that Iran's final response to the killing of Soleimani will be to get the U.S. forces out of the region. This after Iraq's parliament, of course, voted to oust U.S. forces. Do you believe the U.S. should leave Iraq?
No, I don't. You know, that's been the Iranians' intentions ever since 1979. So that's, of course, nothing new.
U.S. forces out of Iraq.
Out of the region completely,
yeah.
As far as the Iranians' intentions. So as to the will of the Iraqi people, that's more complicated than just a parliamentary vote. You have to understand, they did not even have a quorum. Most Sunni and Kurdish parliamentarians didn't show up to the vote. It's also unclear whether the prime minister, because this is an executive order, that the SOFA agreement between the U.S. and Iraq is an executive agreement. It's unclear whether the current prime minister, who has stepped down and is acting in name only, can even go forward with that. It's not clear at all that it is the will of the Iraqi people. We have to continue to be sober about how we analyze our presence in Iraq, and right now I don't think we have any intention of leaving.
Pushing back on this idea that if indeed Iraq doesn't want the U.S. there, what good can our troops possibly do there?
Well, that's a different question, right? I'm saying right now it's not clear that they don't want us there.
But I know, I understand that's what you're saying, but I'm saying if indeed they don't want us there, what good could our troops possibly do there?
Well, at a certain point, we would have to acknowledge that, right? And because it is a bilateral agreement as it currently stands. But if that changed, we would have to acknowledge that reality.
Congressman Dan Crenshaw, Republican of Texas and former Navy SEAL, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Great to be with you.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning, and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed. And now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up first to start your weekend from NPR News.
This is Here and Now. The economy is changing, and economics reporter Adam Davidson says that means we all need to change how we think about our work and embrace what he calls the passion economy. Davidson is a former NPR reporter. He co-founded Planet Money, and he's now a writer for The New Yorker. His new book, The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century, is out this week. Adam Davidson, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the passion economy?
My view here is that we're adjusting to a new kind of economy. It's an economy that can feel very terrifying, that is ripping up a lot of the logic that undergirded the sort of industrial scale economy of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and has caused a lot of disruption, a lot of fear, a lot of real pain, but that this new economic system offers a lot of opportunity too. And you know, I was reporting for many years on a lot of the pain side of this economic transition, but along the way, I became aware of people, regular, relatable people who were figuring out how to thrive at a time when so many others were finding things to be painful and confusing. And so I wanted to add that part of the story to the mix.
And is that part of the story that you have to be passionate about what you're doing, that you've got to have passion in your work?
Yes. I mean, it's that if you think of the 20th century economy, which was built on this engine of mass manufacturing, repeating the same thing over and over again and getting it to more places in the world, making it cheaper and faster, that economy still exists. There still is a big scale economy in some senses. With the internet, scale is even scalier than ever. But that leaves a space, a new space that I don't think has existed to this extent ever before, for people to not try and go for big and scaly and try and take over the globe, but for people to find those things that are uniquely theirs. And that can mean kind of crafty projects on Etsy, but it also means a way to be an accountant, a way to be an engineer. In the book, I tell a lot of stories of sort of regular everyday folks who have cracked this nut. Mm-hmm. And none of them are the kind of people who are born on third base and think they hit a triple kind of folks who often make up a lot of business success stories. These are regular folks, clothes makers, an accountant, chocolate makers, people who have figured out a special way to thrive in an economy that allows them to find those people spread all over the world who most crave whatever it is they provide.
Well, let's talk about a great example that you bring up in your book, which is Bronze Milk Bottle Brush, as a model for how to thrive in this new economy. Explain. Tell me everything about this.
Sure. And it's a story I really love. It's about Braun Brush, which is a brush manufacturer in Long Island. And it started in the mid-1800s when Emanuel Braun, an immigrant from Germany, figured out how to make a really great brush for cleaning milk bottles. You know, back when people got milk delivered daily and then returned their used milk bottles, and they were often stinky and encrusted with dairy and could make you sick. So cleaning them was a big deal, and he came up with a really great innovation. But the problem was, this was before the industrial era. He could only hand make these things and deliver them to customers in Brooklyn and Queens, and that's about it. But over time, his children and grandchildren built the company into a much more modern manufacturer. They make brushes to clean pizza ovens, brushes for pastry shops to rub chocolate on pastry, that kind of thing. And they mass-produced brushes as quickly as possible, sold them everywhere. And then, like so many businesses, they got crushed by cheaper imports from China. And Braun Brush was in a lot of trouble, like so many businesses in America. But Emmanuel Braun's, I believe it's great-great-grandson, Lance Cheney, reinvented the company, going back to that original idea where he custom creates brushes for people with very specific brush needs. Now, you might think, who has a specific brush need? But it turns out NASA does. They,
right.
On the Mars rovers, they needed a very special, very lightweight, very reliable brush to clear away debris from rocks so that the Mars rover could take quality pictures of them.
I was very surprised to hear about all the uses that people have for brushes. And it makes sense, but you never think about it.
There's a million of them. I mean, the nuclear power industry, Lance invented a new kind of brush that just makes it much cheaper and safer to clean and to inspect the insides of nuclear power plants. Basically, what he's doing is, by focusing on the really specific needs of people who desperately need a new kind of brush, or many of them don't even know they need a brush, they have a problem, and he solves that problem, he's able to thrive in a way that nobody in his family ever did. He stops making a brush the second a Chinese manufacturer starts making it, and he moves on to something new. And that is a good kind of rule of thumb for all of us.
That basically, if you are giving people a product that is really made for them, you don't have to worry as much about competition.
Exactly. And if you stay in touch with your customers' needs, if you stay focused on what people want, you can give up on old products and let others mass produce them because you're busy making the next one and the one after that. And this might sound like pretty simple in, oh, yeah, find a niche and fill that niche. But this is really a new thing in economic history. Those same things that terrify us, global trade, outsourcing, mass production, AI, all of those things that can feel like the destroyer of our economy are actually the same things that allow somebody in Long Island or Shanghai or wherever they happen to be to reach that audience spread thinly around the globe who most craves whatever it is they have to offer, to negotiate a really good price for it, and then to continue to stay in touch with and serve that audience. And that is new. It was never possible before.
Well, one of the things that you bring up in this book, which I found very interesting, is the idea of pricing, and that you really need to not think about what is everybody else charging for this and that's what I ought to charge for this product or service, but what is it worth? And then charge that and people will pay it if it's actually worth that amount.
Yeah, I do strongly believe that my passion is we have a pricing crisis in America. And generally, people are pricing things way too low, particularly people who are creating unique, specialized products. And I would include in pricing people's salaries, what people get paid. I think generally, the best bet right now is to offer something special. So not just, oh, I'm an accountant. This is how much accountants make. Or let me calculate my costs and then just charge a profit margin over that. It's to engage your customers and figure out how much do you value this thing? How much do you value the product I make? In some cases, like the story of Jason Blummer, who's an accountant in South Carolina, who's really become a mentor to me. He's a very unlikely accountant.
He's a passionate accountant. He loves his accounting.
A passionate accountant,
right.
A truly passionate accountant who really taught me that if your customers don't get the price you're charging, you have to fire your customers. What I'm arguing is that if you find a passion and you hone that passion and you find an audience that also craves whatever it is you make, that you can find people who are going to be willing to pay money that makes it worth producing that good.
Do you think that everyone can be in the passion economy in 2020 in the United States of America? I mean, could a toll booth operator be passionate about their work in the way that you're describing?
So I'm pretty sure not everyone can be. And I am very mindful that, you know, the people who are most set up to thrive are people with probably at least a college education. You know, this is not a book about geniuses who went to Harvard and used their dad's money to start a business. These are regular folks. Many of them grew up either poor or lower middle class, or working class, who figured some things out. So, yeah, I definitely don't think everyone can do this, but I do think far more people can than are currently doing it. And I don't think it's enough just to say, oh, I'm a toll booth operator, but I'm going to start feeling passionate about being a toll booth operator. So you really need to be picking a place where you are in a position to add unique value, to have some special something. Although, frankly, I'd love it if some toll booth operator called me up and said, no, actually, I've figured it out. Here's how I do it.
You do talk about fast food workers in this book, and that with the right changes, that can be a job that people get excited about.
Yeah, I mean, there is a fact that some, fewer than there should be, but some large companies are beginning to realize that a major variable that they have ignored is the passion of their staff. So what some companies, and I talk about Sweetgreen, a very fast-growing fast food salad company, have figured out is if you can up the passion, the engagement, the excitement of employees just a bit, then that will have huge economic benefit to your company, to your bottom line, as well as just being a better place. The typical fast food worker, when they quit, it costs about $2,000 to find, hire, and train a new employee. So if you reduce the frequency of quitting by just a little bit at a company like Walmart that has, you know, millions of employees, you can meaningfully increase your profit by, you know, billions. So I do hope that more companies understand this and learn these lessons.
Adam Davidson, the new book is called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Adam Davidson, of course, our listeners know from NPR's Planet Money. Before that, NPR and Marketplace. Adam, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
President Trump confirmed today that there were no Americans or Iraqis killed in that Iranian missile strike on two military bases in Iraq. Speaking today in the White House, Trump said Iran appears to be standing down and declined to outline any further military action against Iran.
As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
Let's bring in NPR's Tamara Keith. She's at the White House. And Tamara, Iran's attack was, of course, in retaliation to the killing of top Iranian general Qassem Soleimani. But it sounds like, based on what the president said today, that he has decided not to further escalate this military confrontation. What else is the White House saying today about that attack at those military bases in Iraq?
You know, what is remarkable here is just how much President Trump has vacillated between sort of this tough guy approach and then being very conciliatory. And today it's all about being conciliatory. Just a few days ago, last Saturday, he tweeted this warning to Iran that if it struck U.S. Sites, assets, or Americans, if they were hit, that Iran would be hit very fast and very hard. Well, today he is now saying that he wants peace and and that he sees Iran as standing down. I think that he and other U.S. officials are reading into this missile strike, these strikes from Iran, that although it although they did go after American-related sites, they did not kill Americans, and there's a sense that it may have been on purpose.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that he did announce, which was the economic sanctions on Iran. What more do we know about that decision and how this will be received in Iran?
You know, this is not the first time, obviously, President Trump has imposed sanctions. He also imposed sanctions, economic sanctions, after that attack on a Saudi oil facilities. So he has at times responded to military aggression with a non-military response, with an economic response. And this is part of his maximum pressure campaign against Iran to try to get Iran to come to the table to talk about its nuclear program. Of course, President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Now, in his remarks today, he's saying the whole, you know, Europe, all these other people that were part of the Iran nuclear deal, you should pull out of it, too. And then we should all get together and negotiate something new.
Yeah, with the little time I have with you, let's talk about the optics of this announcement. Trump was flanked by Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and military leaders. What message do you think the White House is trying to send, of course, being able to get to the table with Iran?
Yeah, you know, I was in the room looking at this scene, and they had such stone faces. There was not a movement in their faces. All of these people behind Trump sort of sending this signal of, you know, American military might.
That's NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith. As always, Tamara, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good to talk with you.
$1 billion. That is the new estimate for how many animals have died in the Australia wildfires, which have also killed at least 26 people. The fires have been linked by scientists to climate change, and one of the biggest sources of carbon emissions is the burning of fossil fuels like coal. Well, in Australia, coal is big business. It's one of the main coal producers on Earth. And a man who used to be a coal executive has done a 180 and is now a leading voice for urgent action on climate change. Ian Dunlop was the chair of the Australian Coal Association. He's now a senior member of the advisory board for the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration. He joins us from Sydney. Ian Dunlop, welcome.
Good morning, Jeremy. Nice to talk to you.
Now, coal is not directly causing the fires in Australia, but the use of fossil fuels does increase carbon emissions. Are people, including you, putting some of the blame for the intensity of the fires on the use of coal?
Well, you've got to go back to the question of climate change itself and what's causing it. And the fires are quite clearly linked to increasing global temperatures, changing weather patterns, which have dried out the landscape. And we're now in the midst of the worst drought I think this country's probably ever experienced on the East Coast. And climate change, in turn, is being driven by the increase in fossil fuels. Now, we are a major fossil fuel producer, you know, the largest or second largest coal exporter in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There is no question that the continued use of coal is impacting the climate. And obviously, our coal industry has to think very hard about that. So that is the big argument that is currently going on. Obviously, the immediate priority is to stop these fires and to help people who have been badly affected. But there's no question that we have to start to address the coal issue, because our governments have consistently refused to seriously address climate change and tried to protect the coal industry, and you can't keep doing that.
Well, and in fact, your Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is one of coal's vocal defenders. He took a lump of coal to the country's House of Representatives in 2017 when he was yes. the Treasurer. Listen to this.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is coal. Don't be afraid.
The
Don't be scared.
Won't the Treasurer you. Knows the rule on crops.
It's coal. It was dug up by men and women who work and live in the electorates of those who sit opposite. From the Hunter Valley, as the member for Hunter would know.
Now, here in this country, President Trump has been a vocal defender of the coal industry as well, but I haven't seen him do something like that.
No, I mean, I think it was a particularly stupid thing to do on the part of our Prime Minister, and we reminded him at the time we wouldn't forget. Unfortunately, our political system has locked themselves into the position that it's been going on since our first Prime Minister, John Howard, our Prime Minister back in the 1990s, in the days of the initial Kyoto Protocol, took a denialist position on the problem. And it's been the case with the conservative side of politics ever since. Now, I mean, the Labor Party, the opposition, the more progressive side in some ways, have gone down a similar track, unfortunately, and not really accepting the implications of climate change.
What would the Australian economy look like without coal? How big of a part of the economy is it?
Well, it's not as big a part as it used to be. I mean, it's certainly a major part of the economy, but the fact is that this country is blessed with a range of potential renewable options. You know, we're one of the driest continents on Earth. We also have very high levels of sunlight, high wind conditions. So we can prosper in a low-carbon economy. But make no mistake, I mean, everybody is going, there's going to be a cost to this. It's not just going to happen easily. It is going to have an impact on economies all around the world. But the costs of doing nothing are far greater, as we're now starting to see in Australia, because the impact on the economy of what is now happening in the last, sort of 3 or 4 or 5 weeks is going to be enormous.
Ian Dunlop, as we said at the top, you are a former CEO from the coal industry. What made you change your mind about coal and decide to take action like this on climate change?
Well, I was in the fossil fuel industry from the beginning of my career in the 1950s. And the issue of climate change was around then, not in the sense of it being an immediate priority to address, but in the sense that sooner or later, if you believe the science, it was going to become a problem. As time's gone by over the years, the science has improved dramatically. The evidence has got clearer and clearer. And there comes a point when you have to do something about it. So I left I chaired the Australian Coal Association in the late 80s when we actually did a lot of work on what the alternatives for coal would be for the industry at that time. But I left the industry in the end of the 80s, early 90s, and have spent, I guess, the time since then trying to move in the opposite direction. So it wasn't a road to Damascus transformation. It was a recognition, I think, over a long period that you just couldn't ignore this any longer.
I've only been to Australia once, and I remember thinking that it was one of the most naturally beautiful places I'd ever seen. And then I read this op-ed the other day in the New York Times on January 3rd, and I want to read you a little bit from it. This is from writer Richard Flanagan, who says, Australia yes. today is ground zero for the climate catastrophe. Its glorious yes. Great Barrier Reef is dying. Its World Heritage rainforests are burning. Its giant kelp forests have largely vanished. Numerous towns have run out of water or are about to. And now the vast continent is burning on a scale never before seen. And yet, incredibly, the response of Australia's leaders to this unprecedented national crisis has been not to defend their country, but to defend the fossil fuel industry, a big donor to both major parties, as if they were willing the country to its doom. What is your reaction to that?
He's absolutely right. I mean, that is exactly what's been happening. That's what happens if you deny reality for 30 years, which our political system has basically done. Many of our corporate leaders have done. That's starting to change, but there are many corporate leaders and directors in this country who still will go to their graves believing climate change is crap, in the words of one of our immortal prime ministers. You know, they've been able to dominate the debate in this country with the help of the conservative media, particularly the Murdoch press, who I think are, you know, very active in the same way in the United States with Fox and what have you.
Are they covering these fires? The Murdoch press is in Australia, are they covering these fires as part of climate change, or are they not using those words?
Well, I mean, what's happened is that as it's got clearer and clearer that these things were happening and that climate change is a major factor behind them, the people like the Murdoch press have become ever more hysterical in trying to deny it. You know, they're just, it's a propaganda machine. It's not a proper news organization any longer. And that became patently clear in the election we had in May early this year, where Morrison's Conservative government unexpectedly won. And the help they received from the Murdoch press was phenomenal. And it's complete disinformation. So, you know, they now have a lot to, they're responsible for a lot of these outcomes. And I think the community in this country is starting to realize that that's what's happened. And they won't accept it any longer. Now, it's going to be a difficult transition because these people have a lot of power. And they've chosen to use it in extremely damaging ways historically. And moving them away from that position is going to be difficult.
Are you optimistic?
You have to be in this game. It was always going to be a long-term project to change the economic system away from fossil fuels. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, the world has benefited greatly from the use of fossil fuels since the Industrial Revolution, particularly since World War II. But there comes a point we can have too much of a good thing, and we've reached that point. And the situation, quite simply, is what climate change now represents is an immediate existential threat to the future of human civilization. So we're faced with an absolutely critical choice at this point. We either now start to seriously address this and get people like Murdoch out of the way before they kill us, and put in place the types of innovation that are available and are now, in fact, economic, even without the subsidies given to the fossil fuel industry, and get on with the job. Now, we know what to do. What we need is leaders who can actually do that and get the politicians out of the way who are stopping this actually happening. And that's going to be the big debate here in Australia in the next few weeks.
That's Ian Dunlop, who is a former international oil, gas and coal executive, former chair of the Australian Coal Association as well, and is now an advocate for urgent action on climate change, joining us from Sydney, Australia. Ian, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Good to talk to you.
And you can read some of Ian Dunlop's writing on climate change at hereandnow.org.
Youth incarceration rates have dropped almost in half in under 10 years, according to the Pew Research Center. This comes as a growing number of cities and states are updating their approach to youth crime. In Philadelphia, police, schools, and prosecutors are all working to cut down on the number of youth arrests and incarcerations. YR Media's Zari Tarazona reports on the results and limitations of juvenile justice reforms in the city.
In 2014, Philadelphia started an experiment to cut down on the numbers of kids getting arrested, starting with in-school arrest. The person who spearheaded it was then-Deputy Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel.
When I looked at the data, you know what I said to myself? I'm feeding the system. I'm locking up 1,600 kids a year.
School police officers were under Bethel's supervision at the time. His aha moment came after he went to a conference and heard terms like trauma and the school-to-prison pipeline. He says he had no idea what they were talking about. When he returned home, he pulled up the data on in-school arrest, and he was taken aback by what he saw.
I thought about, let's take that back 20 years. Look at the thousands and thousands of kids we had locked up for minor offenses and where they are now, and why were we doing that? I mean, thousands and thousands of kids for fighting in school, stuff that I did as a kid in school.
So this cop of more than 20 years found himself in a strange situation. He asked his officers to stop arresting and offer diversion programs instead. During the 2018-2019 school year, there were 251 arrests in Philadelphia public schools. Before the diversion program started, there were more than six times that number of arrests. And early studies by Drexel University show that even though school arrests are down, school safety hasn't been compromised. These programs are part of a bigger reform movement in Philadelphia. About a year ago, the city's district attorney's office also changed their policies for juveniles. The goal is to prevent harsh penalties and detention for minor crimes. Here's Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner.
It means something when you walk into juvenile court and instead of having seven or eight courtrooms buzzing, where you have a mountain of cases in each courtroom, you only have two or three.
So the city has backed way off from prosecutions. And what have schools stopped arresting for?
You know, if the kid is fighting in school, you know, they would actually charge him with disorderly conduct.
Officer Latonia Begor is standing in front of a whiteboard. She's looking at the list of minor offenses that used to get students arrested.
Marijuana, pills, trespassing.
She was a beat officer in Philadelphia Public Schools. It used to be her job to put cuffs on a kid.
You know, and it was hard, you know, working a job where you take a 10-year-old and that 10-year-old committed an offense, then we would have to arrest them. So that kind of was my job.
So if you're caught with a box cutter at school in 2014 or earlier, you would have been arrested automatically. But since the city's reforms, if you're caught with one now, you're still not off the hook.
The cops were there, my mom, my dad, everybody was there.
That's Jordan Curver. In the eighth grade, he had a box cutter in his backpack. He said that it had been left there after he went fishing over the weekend.
I felt pretty scared because there was a cop there, and I thought I was really going to jail because most of the people actually go to jail for simple stuff like that.
Curver didn't go to jail. He was offered community-based services as part of the reforms instead. City leaders tout the declining school arrests and court cases, but there's been pushback. Philadelphia's police union has been calling for the DA's replacement, saying overall the city's going too soft on crime. The union didn't respond to repeated requests for comment, but some juvenile justice advocates, including Marsha Levick of the Juvenile Law Center, say the reforms don't go far enough.
Unless and until we are willing to be as open to shrinking our system for those who are convicted of violent crimes, as much as we are the nonviolent offender, we will not substantially change our criminal justice system.
Depending on the crime, some youth offenders don't qualify for alternative programs. And state law requires young people to be tried as adults for certain crimes.
You could do anything and you couldn't fail at it. What would that be?
Every Tuesday, a group of juvenile offenders and their families gather in an office space in Philadelphia's Chinatown. They come to get advice on what to do about their open criminal cases.
So now I'm going to go into what participatory defense is. So
this workshop is being led by a group called the Youth Art and Self-Empowerment Project, otherwise known as YASP. Most of the people on staff were themselves juveniles who were held in adult jail.
I was, like, in solitary confinement, so I was in my cell, like, 22 hours a day.
Miley is one of the youngest staff members at YASP. She's 20. Even if all the current reforms had been in place when she was arrested, they wouldn't have applied to her. Because she had a gun charge, she was held in an adult facility.
Mentally, it changed me because, you're in a cell by yourself. You don't have nothing to do.
At the core of the reforms in Philadelphia is the question, who deserves a second chance? As the police and courts carry out reforms and evaluate them, cities from St. Paul, Minnesota to Orlando, Florida are following Philadelphia's juvenile justice experiment, and in some cases, considering their own reforms. For Here and Now, I'm Zari Terrazona.
And Zari's story was produced by Youth Radio's new network for journalists and artists called YR Media. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.